Our future in outer space is the subject of the new book titled Beyond by our next guest, Chris Impey. His book examines the past, present, and future of space travel and imagines what it would be like to establish a colony in space. As part of the Dalai Lama's program to bring scientific teachings into Tibetan monasteries, Chris Impey has made several trips to India to teach science to Tibetan monks in exile. Impey also has received a grant from NASA to write a history of U.S. space science and astronomy missions. His own research has been supported by $18 million in grants from NASA and the National Science Foundation. Impey is a distinguished professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona. He spoke with Terry last Monday.
Chris Impey, welcome to Fresh Air. So if we had not cut back on funding for the space program, what might we have accomplished by now?
Well, I think we might actually be living on the moon and Mars. Maybe not many of us, but we might have our first bases there. We'd have robust commercial space activity or people routinely in orbit. America wouldn't have had a hiatus of 4 years and counting when we couldn't get astronauts into space. It would be probably quite different.
So what's left of our space program?
It's actually still pretty good. So I think the perception of NASA and the doldrums and that we're in a bad space in our activity is a little exaggerated. NASA's budget isn't growing, but it's also not declining. So they're investing in new technologies. We're going to get a new heavy launch capability in a couple of years. The space station is active and doing scientific experiments. We're not launching satellites. There's a heavy entourage of spacecraft going through the solar system and exploring there. It's not quite as bad as some people make out.
And how bad is it?
Well, it's bad because this flatline budget doesn't allow you to do adventurous, creative things. It really limits you. NASA can only do one big, clever thing every decade or so. And that's kind of tough because there's five or six or seven big, clever ideas on the table, things we'd like to do.
There's a new chapter in the space race, and that is that China has entered. And China is buying up a lot of resources on Earth, like water and mineral rights in Africa. So what is it looking to do on the moon?
Well, they have a multi-pronged space program. And the contrast, of course, is that they've grown their space activity at the rate of their economy, which has been 10% a year for a decade and maybe slimming down a bit. But that's compared to our flatline budget for NASA. So they've got a doubling of their activity in less than a decade. They're looking to build their own space station. And it might be up there at a time when the International Space Station is deorbited and burned up in the atmosphere. They're looking to go to the moon. They're looking to have a Mars rover. And they're actually, unlike one of the stereotypes that they're just sort of copying our technology, they're actually innovating. And they have very young engineers in their space program, very keen, very well-trained, very ambitious.
If we, really stepped up the space program now and reinvigorated it with a supply of money, are there new innovations that have already been made that we could apply to space travel?
I think the innovations that we haven't seen yet are going to come in the small scale. Humans in space, it attracts our attention. It engages us. But, people are tricky in space. They're very fragile. They need to be fed and clothed, and they get bored, and they get lonely. And protecting them costs a lot of money and takes a lot of resources. The miniaturization of space travel, we really haven't seen a lot of, but it's happening very fast. Particularly, there are things called CubeSats that are Rubik's Cube-type miniaturized satellites, where the cost of building a little package and putting it in a 10-centimeter cube is maybe $50,000 or $100,000. So universities or even student groups get together, and they bundle these and then launch them together. And also, we're putting what amounts to cell phone technology in space, the sort of cameras and sensors that are routine in our cell phones. You can put those in Earth orbit and do Earth-looking stuff or eventually outward-looking stuff. So these small packages that are much, much cheaper to launch than a person are really going to revolutionize some of the things that happen in space.
So these small packages, as you put it, are launched within rockets?
They're launched within rockets, but they're individual. The individual payloads are tiny, and you can just bundle a lot of them together into a conventional rocket or maybe use a small rocket. And so, for instance, last year, I think 140 CubeSats were launched, and that was more than in all the previous years, and the number is sort of doubling every year. So this is a real growth industry. And one part of it is it getting away from the NASA model. This is maybe one area where NASA has, you know, taken a particular tack, and which is NASA's really good at these big, complex, billion-dollar missions, the Hubble Space Telescope, Cassini, the Mars rovers. But they're big, they're expensive, they take a decade, they're huge commitments. And NASA's not really gone in this sort of quick, cheap, fast, and small route. And I think the private sector is doing that more vigorously than NASA is.
So what are some of the information or whatever that we're getting from these small packages that are being launched in space?
Well, one interesting example using the sort of cell phone technologies and cameras that are really not much better than on your cell phone is if you throw hundreds and hundreds of these little cell phone satellites into orbit, you just tolerate the fact that some of them will break or be destroyed or fall to the ground. And you have enough of them in orbit that they're planning to have a network that will be able to take a picture of every place on the Earth's surface literally every day or so. Maybe not with the resolution of the best GPS, so like a meter resolution, but that ability to monitor the Earth every day or so, everywhere, there's never been that capability. So it's a brand new capability enabled by these sort of cheap, small technologies.
You write about the possibility, perhaps a far-fetched possibility, of there eventually being a space elevator to get around the amount of fuel that you need to launch a rocket where you're basically sitting on an explosion all the time. So what's the vision for the space elevator?
A space elevator is, of course, a cool idea out of science fiction. And Arthur C. Clarke was famously asked when we would have our space elevators. And he said 50 years after people stopped laughing. And I think people are about to stop laughing. The idea is basically you string a cable up into space to the point where it's suspended, like in an Indian rope trick, by the spinning force of the Earth up to a geostationary point, the place where a satellite would be stationary above your head orbiting the Earth. That's a huge cable. That's a 100,000-kilometer cable into space. And so can you find a material strong enough to make a cable that long suspended against gravity? And on the Earth, you can't. So an Earth-based space elevator is not possible with our current materials. But a moon elevator, where the gravity is 1/6, actually could be done with current technology.
How do you even create a cable that long?
You build it sort of in stages. I mean, just as you would span a chasm sort of by sending a thread across and then turning it into a rope and then a cable and then braiding it into a big thing, you sort of do the same thing. You'll suspend a very gossamer thin cable up as far as you can and then gradually build it into a more robust cable where it's handling its weight as it gets constructed. It's an incredible construction project, but I've met engineers, some at NASA, some elsewhere. They love this stuff. I mean, once they know it's possible, doesn't break laws of physics, doesn't break the laws of materials, they just want to do it. I mean, sign them on. So eventually, it could happen on the moon. And the reason to do it on the moon, which doesn't seem like a great place to go, is that it's the great staging place for a space activity. If you can go to the moon with a base, you can mine the soil there for oxygen, which you could breathe or turn into rocket fuel. There's water in the lunar soil. So you can survive on the moon. And then if you build a space elevator, you can get essentially anywhere in the solar system for the cost of almost no rocket fuel.
So I'm still trying to envision what the idea behind this is. So you have this like incredibly long cable hanging down from the moon. And how does the rocket or the whatever get lifted onto the moon?
So it's not a rocket. So just imagine you're holding a cable or a rope, a finite length piece of rope, and you're just spinning. You're just spinning it around, and it'll go straight out away from you by the centrifugal force. Well, the moon and the Earth are spinning too. So if you have a cable going into the air sufficiently high, then it will be suspended by the force caused by the spinning object that you're standing on. And it will just appear to go straight up into the air, right out into space, and hover there. It's perfectly balanced. And so then you don't need a rocket. You just make this cable robust enough that you can attach elevator cars to it, going up and down, just carrying things up and down.
So do you think this is one of the things more likely to actually happen in the future?
Well, it's a 20 to 30 year time frame. The fact that it can be done with present technology doesn't mean that it's easy. I've seen estimates of $10 to $20 billion for the cost of a space elevator. That's a lot of money, but if a set of corporations or governments got together to combine on it, it could possibly liberate an economic activity that dwarfed that number.
What is one of the more exciting developments in space travel or space life that you expect to see in your lifetime?
I think the interesting and exciting thing will be when we get a community that's living off Earth for the first time to see how they evolve. If they can get beyond the sheer hardship of it, just the difficulty of being so far from the Earth, of being in close quarters, then at some point, after maybe only a couple of generations, these people will become an offshoot of the human tree. They will probably evolve into something else. They'll evolve physiologically quite quickly, because if the gravity is less, as it would be on Mars or the Moon, they will change. Their physical bodies will change even while they're alive, and if they have children and then grandchildren, they will change even more. And then psychologically, they will start to feel like a new colony, a new people. As we moved around the planet and did so for reasons of just sheer exploration or freedom or wanting open spaces, people diversified. They became quite different. And so the first off-Earth humans that live there and die there and then have children and grandchildren, they're going to quite quickly turn into maybe even a new species.
Among the things you've done, I mean, you were a professor at the University of Arizona in Tucson, but you've also taught in a special program to teach astronomy, cosmology to Tibetan monks in exile in the Himalayas in India. And it's a special program called Science for Monks Leadership Program. And it was actually organized by the Dalai Lama, who wrote the introduction to one of your earlier books, which is called Humble Before the Void. And this book is all about you teaching science to these Tibetan monks. And in the introduction, the Dalai Lama writes, "My own interest in science began when I was a young boy growing up in Tibet and came to understand the importance of science as another approach to understanding reality." What did the Dalai Lama tell you about why he thought it was important to teach science to Tibetan monks?
And I've only met him once, but the message he has for his own cohort of monastics is that he doesn't want his culture to become a museum piece. You know, without a homeland, their culture is sort of eroding or being destroyed. And the monastic tradition is venerable, but it really hasn't changed for centuries. And he wants his monks and nuns to be trained for the 21st century, and so he wanted to inject math and science into the curriculum. And he's famously said that when he was four and picked to be the 14th reincarnation of the Bodhisattva of Compassion, if that hadn't happened, he'd have been an engineer. So he thinks very analytically, he thinks very logically, he's very engaged with talking to scientists, and he wanted that to become part of what monks learn, to be in the 21st century, to not be isolated culturally. And it's a wonderful program. I enjoy going there pretty much every year.
But on the other hand, the whole point of being monastic in some ways is that you are isolated.
Yes, it gives them an amazing separation with which to approach these sort of ineffable questions of our existence and origin and dark matter and dark energy. So when they engage the topics of cosmology, even though their math and physics training is slight, they ask the most fundamental questions. They're brilliant students because they're completely committed to learning. They're totally engaged. They're indefatigable. And they ask these incredible questions.
Give us an example of an incredible question.
Well, sometimes as an instructor, you even get frustrated by incredible questions because they bring you to a halt. So we were talking one time about how astronomers measure the age of the universe to be 13.8 billion years. And also about the Big Bang and so on. And one of them just put his hand up almost sheepishly and asked, "Well, you measure time with radioactive decay and so on. How does time have any meaning before there were atoms? Or how do you measure time itself? Or what is the meaning of time?" You know, so they just unravel to the most profound question that will floor most physicists.
And how do you come back to a question like that? What do you say?
Well, it, of course, derails my entire lesson plan because we end up in a big discussion about the nature of time, which, you know, philosophers and physicists still wrestle with. Is time an emergent property, you know, that doesn't have any underlying reality? Is time a function of the way the universe is, such that if the universe were slightly different, time as we understand it wouldn't exist? We essentially spin off into these metaphysical and philosophical discussions.
What was the monk's understanding of stars and the planets when you began teaching?
So they do have a quite archaic view of cosmology. Their historical cosmology in the Buddhist tradition, which is inherited from Hinduism, involves Mount Meru at the center of the universe. It's sort of a, you know, very much a pre-Copernican, earth-centered, almost flat earth view. And the stars and the distances to the stars don't have any real meaning to them. However, Buddhism and Hinduism are rich traditions, and the Dalai Lama's noted that there are 15 or 16 different cosmologies in their tradition. And he just laughs and says, well, 12 of them are just silly and wrong. So, you know, the monks are allowed and encouraged to be selective in which part of their tradition they accept. And some parts of their tradition are strikingly concordant with modern cosmology. They have parts of their tradition that talk about deep time, cycles of time of billions or even trillions of years. They have parts of their tradition that accommodate the idea of infinite worlds with life on them. So they are fully capable of taking the vastness of time and space that we understand in modern cosmology, and it's assimilating it because it's part of their tradition too.
What was the monk's reaction to the Big Bang theory, the idea that this enormous explosion is the start of, you know, of our planet and the start of life? And how does that compare with the belief that they had before you started teaching them about science?
So the Big Bang itself is probably one area of cosmology that doesn't sit naturally in the Buddhist tradition, because they believe in endless time, in cycles of time, and space that might come into being and then go out of existence, and life that does the same. However, cosmology is sort of moving in their direction, because astronomers, having now diagnosed the Big Bang back to the first tiny fractions of a second, have started asking their own profound questions, such as, you know, is the Big Bang the only space-time we can talk about, or what caused the Big Bang, or what was the precursor state? And out of those speculations, they've come up with ideas that if the universe, say, was a quantum fluctuation, there might have been other quantum fluctuations, and so perhaps there's a multiverse concept. And time is endless, where the origination of our space and time in the Big Bang is just one event. And that's starting to sound similar to the Buddhist tradition.
Chris Impey, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much. And safe travels back to India in October.
Thanks, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
Chris Impey spoke with Terry last Monday. Impey is the author of the new book, Beyond, Our Future in Space. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Gould.